Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning, everyone. As I said before the news, we will devote our program today almost exclusively to live coverage of the Sonia Sotomayor confirmation hearings. The question just began a little while ago, and barring something very unexpected, this morning's questioning is sure to be the heart of these hearings. In fact, we'll go in live here in just a second because Jeff Sessions, the ranking Republican on the committee, is just beginning to question Judge Sotomayor right now, and he's expected to be the toughest questioner in these entire hearings. Just by way of background, just so you have this context, for those of you who don't know, Jeff Sessions, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III, to be precise, was himself denied confirmation by the Senate Judiciary Committee when President Reagan tried to appoint him as a judge. We talked about this yesterday. And interestingly, it was because he was considered racist, or at least racially insensitive. He had dismissed the NAACP as a communist organization and as un-American. He used that word. He said the NAACP, quote, forced civil rights down the throats of people, unquote. He had a suspicious record as a prosecutor in Alabama for bringing charges against civil rights workers and a few other things that led him to be rejected by the Senate Judiciary Committee, of which he is now a member, for a judgeship himself. So when he questioned Sotomayor over bias for invoking the idea that life experience matters, he comes at it with that particular experience and still many questions about his own racial sensitivity by many, many critics of Senator Jefferson Beauregard Sessions III. So he is questioning Judge Sotomayor right now. Let's go live. Judge Sotomayor is answering his question.
For society. In that conversation with the students, I was focusing on what district court judges do and what circuit court judges do. And I noted that district court judges find the facts, and they apply the facts to the individual case. And when they do that, their holding, their finding, doesn't bind anybody else. Appellate judges, however, establish precedent. They decide what the law says in a particular situation. That precedent has policy ramifications because it binds not just the litigants in that case, it binds all litigants in similar cases and cases that may be influenced by that precedent. I think if my speech is heard outside of the minute and a half that YouTube presents and its full context examined, that is very clear that I was talking about the policy ramifications of precedent and never talking about appellate judges or courts making the policy that that Congress makes.
Judge, I would just say I don't think it's that clear. I looked at that tape several times, and I think a person could reasonably believe it meant more than that. But yesterday you spoke about your approach to rendering opinions and said, quote, I seek to strengthen both the rule of law and faith in the impartiality of the justice system, and I would agree. But you have previously said this, I am willing to accept that we who judge must not deny differences resulting from experiences and heritage, but attempt, as the Supreme Court suggests, continuously to judge when those opinions, sympathies, and prejudices are appropriate. So first I'd like to know, do you think there's any circumstance in which a judge should allow their prejudices to impact their decision making?
Never their prejudices. I was talking about the very important goal of the justice system is to ensure that the personal biases and prejudices of a judge do not influence the outcome of a case. What I was talking about was the obligation of judges to examine what they're feeling as they're adjudicating a case and to ensure that that's not influencing the outcome. Life experiences have to influence you. We're not robots to listen to evidence and don't have feelings. We have to recognize those feelings and put them aside. That's what my speech was saying,
well,
because that's our job.
But the statement was, I willingly accept that we who judge must not deny the differences resulting from experience and heritage, but continuously to judge when those opinions, sympathies, and prejudices are appropriate. That's exactly opposite of what you're saying, is it not?
I don't believe so, Senator, because all I was saying is, because we have feelings and different experiences, we can be led to believe that our experiences are appropriate. We have to be open-minded to accept that they may not be, and that we have to judge always that we're not letting those things determine the outcome. But there are situations in which some experiences are important in the process of judging because the law asked us to use those experiences.
Well, I understand that, but let me just follow up that you say in your statement that you want to do what you can to increase the faith in the impartiality of our system, but isn't it true this statement suggests that you accept that there may be sympathies, prejudices, and opinions that legitimately kind of influence a judge's decision? And how can that further faith in the impartiality of the system?
I think the system is strengthened when judges don't assume they're impartial, but when judges test themselves to identify when their emotions are driving a result or their experiences are driving a result, then the law is not.
I agree with that. I know one judge that says that if he has a feeling about a case, he tells his law clerks to watch me. I do not want my biases, sympathies, or prejudices to influence this decision, which I've taken an oath to make sure is impartial. I just am very concerned that what you're saying today is quite inconsistent with your statement that you willingly accept that your sympathies, opinions, and prejudices may influence your decision-making.
Well, as I have tried to explain, what I try to do is to ensure that they're not. If I ignore them and believe that I'm acting without them, without looking at them and testing that I'm not, then I could, unconsciously or otherwise, be led to be doing the exact thing I don't want to do, which is to let something but the law command the result.
Well, yesterday you also said that your decisions have always been made to serve the larger interest of impartial justice. A good aspiration, I agree. But in the past, you've repeatedly said this: I wonder whether achieving the goal of impartiality is possible at all in even most cases, and I wonder whether by ignoring our differences as women, men, or people of color, we do a disservice to both the law and society. Aren't you saying there that you expect your background and heritage to influence your decision-making?
What I was speaking about in that speech was harkened back to what we were just talking about a few minutes ago, which is life experiences do influence us in good ways. That's why we seek the enrichment of our legal system from life experiences that can affect what we see or how we feel, but that's not what drives a result. The impartiality is an understanding that the law is what commands the result. And so to the extent that we are asking the question, because most of my speech was an academic discussion about what should we be thinking about, what should we be considering in this process, and accepting that life experiences could make a difference, but I wasn't encouraging the belief or attempting to encourage the belief that I thought that that should drive the result.
Judge, I think it's consistent in the comments I've quoted to you and your previous statements that you do believe that your backgrounds will affect the result in cases. And that's troubling me. So that is not impartiality. Don't you think that is not consistent with your statement that you believe your role as a judge is to serve the larger interest of impartial justice?
No, sir. As I've indicated, my record shows that at no point or time have I ever permitted my personal views or sympathies to influence an outcome of a case. In every case where I have identified a sympathy, I have articulated it and explained to the litigant why the law requires a different result.
Judge,
I do not permit my sympathies, personal views, or prejudices to influence the outcome of my cases.
Well, you said something similar to that yesterday, that in each case I've applied the law to the facts at hand. But you've repeatedly made this statement, quote, "I accept the proposition. I accept the proposition that a difference there will be by the presence of women and people of color on the bench, and that my experiences affect the facts I choose to see as a judge." First, that's troubling to me as a lawyer. When I present evidence, I expect the judge to hear and see all the evidence that gets presented. How is it appropriate for a judge ever to say that they will choose to see some facts and not others?
It's not a question of choosing to see some facts or another, Senator. I didn't intend to suggest that. And in the wider context, the point I was making was that our life experiences do permit us to see some facts and understand them more easily than others. But in the end, you're absolutely right. That's why we have appellate judges that are more than one judge, because each of us from our life experiences will more easily see different perspectives argued by parties. But judges do consider all of the arguments of litigants. I have most of my opinions, if not all of them, explain to parties why the law requires what it does.
Well, do you stand by your statement that my experiences affect the facts I choose to see?
No, sir. I don't stand by the understanding of that statement that I will ignore other facts or other experiences because I haven't had them. I do believe that life experiences are important to the process of judging. They help you to understand and listen, but that the law requires a result, and it will command you to the facts that are relevant to the disposition of the case.
Well, I would just note you've made that statement in individual speeches about seven times over a number of years span, and it's concerning to me. So I would just say to you, I believe in Judge Cederbaum's formulation. And she said, and you disagreed, and this was really the context of your speech, and you used her statement as sort of a beginning of your discussion. And you said she believes that a judge, no matter what their gender or background, should strive to reach the same conclusion, and she believes that's possible. You then argue that you don't think it's possible in all, maybe even most cases. You deal with the famous quote of Justice O'Connor in which she says a wise old man should reach the same decision as a wise old woman, and you push back from that. You say you don't think that's necessarily accurate, and you doubt the ability to be objective in your analysis. And so how can you reconcile your speeches, which repeatedly assert that impartiality is a mere aspiration, which may not be possible in all or even most cases, with your oath that you've taken twice, which requires impartiality?
My friend Judge Cederbaum is here this afternoon, and we are good friends, and I believe that we both approach judging in the same way, which is looking at the facts of each individual case and applying the law to those facts. I also, as I explained, was using a rhetorical flourish that fell flat. I knew that Justice O'Connor couldn't have meant that if judges reached different conclusions, legal conclusions, that one of them wasn't wise. That couldn't have been her meaning, because reasonable judges disagree on legal conclusions in some cases. So I was trying to play on her words. My play fell flat. It was bad, because it left an impression that I believed that life experiences commanded a result in a case, but that's clearly not what I do as a judge. It's clearly not what I intended. In the context of my broader speech, which was attempting to inspire young Hispanic, Latino students and lawyers to believe that their life experiences added value to the process.
Well, I can see that perhaps as a layperson's approach to it, but as a judge who's taken this oath, I'm very troubled that you would repeatedly, over a decade or more, make statements that consistently, any fair reading of these speeches consistently argues that this ideal and commitment, I believe every judge is committed, must be, to put aside their personal experiences and biases and make sure that that person before them gets a fair day in court. Judge, on the so philosophy can impact your judging. I think it's much more likely to reach full flower if you sit on the Supreme Court than it will on a lower court where you're subject to review by your colleagues in the higher court. So with regard to how you approach law and your personal experiences, let's look at the New Haven firefighters case, the Ritchie case. In that case, the city of New Haven told firefighters that they would take an exam, set forth the process for it, that would determine who would be eligible for promotion. The city spent a good deal of time and money on the exam to make it a fair test of a person's ability to see to serve as a supervisory fireman, which in fact has the awesome responsibility at times to send their firemen into a dangerous building that's on fire. And they had a panel that did oral exams, wasn't all written, consisting of one Hispanic and one African American and one white. And according to the Supreme Court, this is what the Supreme Court held. The New Haven officials were careful to ensure broad racial participation in the design of the test and its administration. The process was open and fair. There was no genuine dispute that the examinations were job-related and consistent with business purposes, business necessity. But after the city saw the results of the exam, it threw out those results because, quote, not enough of one group did well enough on the test. The Supreme Court then found that the city, and I quote, rejected the test results solely because the higher-scoring candidates were white. After the tests were completed, the raw racial results became the predominant rationale for the city's refusal to certify the results, close quote. So you've stated that your background affects the facts you choose to see. Was the fact that the New Haven firefighters had been subject to discrimination one of the facts you chose not to see in this case?
No, sir. The panel was composed of me and two other judges in a very similar case, the Seventh Circuit, in an opinion authored by Judge Easterbrook. I'm sorry, I misspoke. It wasn't Judge Easterbrook. It was Judge Posner. Saw the case in an identical way. And in neither judge, I've confused some statements that Senator Leahy made with this case, and I apologize. In a very similar case, the Sixth Circuit approached a very similar issue in the same way. So a variety of different judges on the appellate court were looking at the case in light of established Supreme Court and Second Circuit precedent, and determined that the city facing potential liability under Title VII could choose not to certify the test if it believed an equally good test could be made with a different impact on affected groups. The Supreme Court, as it is its prerogative in looking at a challenge, established a new consideration or a different standard for the city to apply, and that is, was there substantial evidence that they would be held liable on the law? That was a new consideration. Our panel didn't look at that issue that way because it wasn't argued to us in the case before us, and because the case before us was based on existing precedent. So it's a different test.
Judge, there was a apparently unease within your panel. I was really disappointed, and I think a lot of people have been, that the opinion was so short. It was per curiam. It did not discuss the serious legal issues that the case raised. And I believe that's a legitimate criticism of what you did. But it appears, according to Stuart Taylor, the respected legal writer for the National Journal, that Stuart Taylor concluded that it appears that Judge Cabranes was concerned about the outcome of the case, was not aware of it because it was a per curiam, unpublished opinion, but it began to raise the question of whether rehearing should be granted. You say you're bound by the superior authority, but the fact is, when the question of rehearing, that Second Circuit authority that you say covered the case, some says it didn't cover so clearly, but that was up for debate. And the circuit voted, and you voted not to reconsider the prior case. You voted to stay with the decision of the circuit. And in fact, your vote was the key vote. Had you voted with Judge Cabranes, himself of Puerto Rican ancestry, had you voted with him, you could have changed that case. So in truth, you weren't bound by that case. Had you seen it a different way, you must have agreed with it and agreed with the opinion and stayed with it until it was reversed by the court. Let me just mention this. In 1997...
Is that a question or the...
Well, that was a response to some of what you said, Mr. Chairman, because you misrepresented factually how the posture of the case.
Well, now, I obviously will disagree with that, but that we'll have a chance to vote on this issue.
In 1997, when you came before the Senate and I was a new senator, I asked you this. In a suit challenging a government racial preference and quota or set-aside, will you follow the Supreme Court decision in Adoran and subject racial preferences to the strictest judicial scrutiny? Close quote. In other words, I ask you, would you follow the Supreme Court's binding decision in Adoran versus Pena? In Adoran, the Supreme Court held that all governmental discrimination, including affirmative action programs that discriminated by race of an applicant, must face strict scrutiny in the courts. In other words, this is not a light thing to do. When one race is favored over another, you must have a really good reason for it, or it's not acceptable. After Adoran, the government agencies must prove there is a compelling state interest in support of any decision to treat people differently by race. This is what you answered. In my view, the Adoran court correctly determined that the same level of scrutiny, strict scrutiny, applies for the purpose of evaluating the constitutionality of all government classifications, whether at the state or federal level based on race, close quote. So that was your answer, and it deals with government being the city of New Haven. You made a commitment to this committee to follow Adoran. In view of this commitment you gave me 12 years ago, why are the words Adoran, equal protection, and strict scrutiny completely missing from any of your panel's discussion of this decision?
Because those cases were not what was at issue in this decision. And in fact, those cases were not what decided the Supreme Court's decision. The Supreme Court parties were not arguing the level of scrutiny that would apply with respect to intentional discrimination. The issue is a different one before our court and the Supreme Court, which is what's a city to do when there is proof that its test disparately impacts a particular group. And the Supreme Court decided, not on the basis of strict scrutiny, that what it did here was wrong, what the city did here was wrong, but on the basis that the city's choice was not based on a substantial basis in evidence to believe it would be held liable under the law. Those are two different standards, two different questions that a case would present.
But, Judge, it wasn't that simple. This case was recognized pretty soon as a big case, at least. I noticed what perhaps kicked off Judge Cabranes' concern was a lawyer saying it was the most important discrimination case that the circuit had seen in 20 years. They were shocked. They got a basically one-paragraph decision per curiam unsigned back on that case. Judge Cabranes apparently raised this issue within the circuit, asked for rehearing. Your vote made the difference in not having a rehearing in bank. And he said, quote, municipal employer.
We leave this hearing now as the House is meeting.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. As we bring you coverage of the Sonia Sotomayor confirmation hearings in the Senate and in the Senate Judiciary Committee, some very interesting questioning there from Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican of Alabama. And we will get back to this hearing in just a minute, but some very interesting questions having to do with the Ritchie case, the firefighters case in Connecticut just now. And let's go back in. We have the feed and Senator Sessions still with sharp questioning of Judge Sotomayor.
Was dealt with in such a cursory manner.
The panel decision was based on a 78-page district court opinion. The opinion referenced it, in its per curiam, the court incorporated it directly, but it was referenced by the circuit, and it relied on that very thoughtful, thorough opinion by the district court. And that opinion discussed Second Circuit precedent in its fullest extent. Justice Cabranes had one view of the case, the panel had another. The majority of the vote, it wasn't just my vote, the majority of the court, not just my vote, denied the petition for rehearing. The court left to the Supreme Court the question of how an employer should address what no one disputed was prima facie evidence that its test disparately impacted on a group. That was undisputed by everyone, that the case law did permit employees who had been disparately impacted to bring a suit. The question was, for the city, was it racially discriminating when it didn't accept those tests, or was it attempting to comply with the law?
Well, Judge, I think it's not fair to say that a majority, I guess it's fair to say the majority voted against rehearing, but it was 6-6. Unusual that one of the judges had to challenge a panel decision, and your vote made the majority not to rehear it. And Ritchie did deal with some important questions. Some of the questions that we have got to talk about as a nation, we've got to work our way through. I know there's concern on both sides of this issue, and we should do it carefully and correctly. But do you think that Frank Ritchie and the other firefighters whose claims you dismissed felt that their arguments and concerns were appropriately understood and acknowledged by such a short opinion from the court?
We were very sympathetic and expressed our sympathy to the firefighters who challenged the city's decision, Mr. Ritchie and the others. We understood the efforts that they had made in taking the test. We said as much. They did have before them a 78-page thorough opinion by the district court. They obviously disagreed with the law as it stood under Second Circuit precedent. That's why they were pursuing their claims and did pursue them further. In the end, the body that had the discretion and power to decide how these tough issues should be decided, not along the precedent that had been recognized by our circuit court and another, at least the Sixth Circuit, but along what the court thought would be the right test or standard to apply. And that's what the Supreme Court did. It answered that important question because it had the power to do that, not the power, but the ability to do that because it was faced with the arguments that suggested that. The panel was dealing with precedent and arguments that relied on our precedent.
Thank you, Judge, and I appreciate this opportunity. And I would just say, though, had the per curiam opinion stood without a rehearing requested by one of the judges in the whole circuit and kicked off the discussion, it's very, very unlikely that we would have heard about this case or the Supreme Court would have taken it up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Live coverage of Sonia Sotomayor at her confirmation hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. That was the full round of questioning by Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican of Alabama. And that is the heart of the matter. That is probably the most direct and most challenging questioning that Sonia Sotomayor will get during these confirmation hearings. So we will take a break now, and we will talk about what we just heard and the implications for her confirmation going forward. If you'd rather continue to listen to the hearings as Senator Herb Kohl, Democrat from Wisconsin, begins his questioning, you have that option on our website, WNYC.org. But when we continue here on 93.9 and AM 820, we will break down what we just heard, that 30-minute exchange between Senator Sessions and Supreme Court Justice nominee Sonia Sotomayor. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Quick reminder that we have six semifinalists in our Uncommon Economic Indicators video contest, and it's time for you to vote. Go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show to see these six uncommon videos, each 2 minutes or less. Vote for your favorite, and we'll show the top three at our Jerome L. Green Performance Space later this month. Vote at WNYC.org, click on Brian Lehrer Show for the semifinalists in our Uncommon Economic Indicators video contest. Again, just so you know what we'll be doing this morning, mostly live coverage of the Sonia Sotomayor confirmation hearings. If you want to listen to the questioning beginning now by Democratic Senator Herb Kohl of Wisconsin, we are streaming that live on our website, WNYC.org. We're going to keep it here for a little while and discuss the exchange that we just heard for the last half hour between Sotomayor's main antagonist on the committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, Republican Jeff Sessions of Alabama. So joining me now for that is Jamie Floyd, host of Best Defense on the In Session TV network. She also worked in the Clinton administration, where her job included vetting judicial nominees. Jamie, welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning.
That was pretty much what we expected from Sessions, right? He went after her hard on the wise Latina remark from several of her speeches, and he went after her hard on the content of her Ritchie case decision, the firefighters case from New Haven, the discrimination case, and went after her hard on the brevity of that decision, the fact that it was not fleshed out as to why they ruled in defense of the city or in support of the city. Was anything for you new or unexpected?
No, I expected him to, if I can use the word, attack her respectfully in those three substantive areas. I thought the tone was respectful, but rather aggressive. He made his record. I think we know how he'll vote. And he was speaking more, I think, to his constituency than he was to her or to the other members of the committee. She was well prepared for those questions. And in a way, he did her a favor as one of the more senior members of this committee. He allowed her to get some of this on the table and out of the way early on in this day of questioning. So I think it was pretty much what was to be expected. I would even call it somewhat entertaining. This is what the process is all about, and it allows the American people to see these issues fleshed out before she is ultimately confirmed, which I predict she will be.
Well, I don't know that it really gets it off the table. Perhaps this sets up a whole day, maybe day and a half of questioning by the Republicans on the committee, following up on, you know, every jot and tittle of the answers that she gave.
No, no, I didn't say off the table. I said on the table.
Yeah, on the table, right.
It puts it on the table.
Puts it on the table.
Yeah, and so we begin the airing of these issues,
yes.
And so it's not the pink elephant in the room anymore.
So let's talk about...
In a way, that does her a favor, I think, and we can now begin to openly address the questions that everybody's wanted to talk about with this woman, rather than talk about them behind her back, frankly, which is what's been happening in the press and on the Senate, in the Senate behind closed doors. Now we're talking about them in public, on television, and here on your program.
And let's look at some of the particulars there. And by the way, again, on our schedule, listeners, if you're interested, we will come back to the hearings after Senator Cole, and we will hear Senator Russell Feingold question Sotomayor next, and then Senator Orrin Hatch after that. Those two will be in the 11 o'clock hour. But on the Ritchie case, Sotomayor said that she was bound by precedent in Ritchie. Obviously, the Supreme Court disagreed. But pertaining to what cities can do,
right?
She said that there was a very particular question on the table that had to do with whether a city would be liable under the law for throwing out the racial discrimination case. For throwing out the firefighters test on the basis of the disparate results, or for that matter, for not throwing out the firefighters test on the basis of disparate results. Do you understand, as a matter of law, what she was saying there?
Yeah. Well, what she's saying, and as you point out, the Supreme Court didn't really disagree with her answer today, but disagreed with her decision as a judge, with the panel's decision as a court. She's saying that our role as a court and our decision was a very narrow one. We were looking at the jurisdiction's power and authority to make the decision that it made. We weren't looking at the larger underlying political, social issues that this case has raised and that most people are talking about, the controversies that we've all been talking about since she's been nominated. That's not what the court was about in the case. And federal courts and judges are most often about very narrow, particular, and frankly rather boring questions of jurisdiction, of authority, very narrow legal issues. And so her answer to the question was precisely that. My role as a judge was very limited. And yes, I realize that the U.S. Supreme Court disagreed, but it was on this very narrow question, not on the big picture controversy that everyone is talking about. And I think the U.S. Supreme Court would agree on that narrow discussion, that the question was a narrow, limited legal question, not the big policy political debate that everyone is discussing. And, you know, this is the interesting thing about law and lawyers and judging. Very often what we ask judges to do is keep their focus on the narrow, mundane, dull legal issues and not be distracted by the larger political, more exciting and entertaining questions of the day. That's what a judge is supposed to do, and her answer is that is precisely what she did in the case, despite all of the criticism that's coming her way for what she would say is a deliberate misunderstanding of her role in the case.
Also with us briefly is Erica Gonzalez, opinion page editor at El Diario La Prensa. She is covering the hearing at the hearing, and she is good enough to have stepped out of the hearing room for just a minute to talk with us right now after that central exchange in this process between Senator Sessions and Judge Sotomayor. Erica, thanks for coming on WNYC. Hi.
No problem, Brian. Hi.
What did it feel like in the room during all of that? Was it very tense?
I think that, first of all, I'm in the press section, which is you're literally elbow to elbow. We're like sardines. And I think you can hear like the flutter of keys when it comes to certain questions, like with the Rishi case, for example. But it generally feels, at least today and yesterday, that there's like this atmosphere of support. She has her family here. Cesar Perales from the Puerto Rican Legal Defense and Education Fund, which has come up in a number of criticisms and attacks against Sotomayor, is also here. So it doesn't feel hostile. It feels actually between observers and supporters, it feels sort of cordial, respectful, attentive. And yesterday, as you might have seen, there were a few outbursts. There were four outbursts by anti-abortion, extremists.
Right, but let's stay on what's happening today and the exchange with Senator Sessions. Did you get the sense that was kind of theater as it needed to be, or that it was something
theater.
Something
it was
more than
theater.
That?
It was definitely theater, and they were clearly when, his tone was snide when he was cutting out through some of her speeches and throwing them back, and there were some titters in the hearing room. But, I think because Senator Leahy basically addressed a lot of the criticism, and he was able to sort of diffuse a lot of what was anticipated from Senator Sessions, this senator who has called the NAACP communist-inspired in the past.
Are you familiar, Erica, with Judge Cabranes, who Senator Sessions cited?
With him, what I did notice is that he and other Republicans have been very pointed about citing other judges or lawyers who are Latino, and so you probably heard Sessions refer to Cabranes as Puerto Rican. So that's no coincidence.
Right. And Jamie Floyd, you're familiar with Cabranes.
Yes.
He sits on the same court and disagreed with Sotomayor on the Rishi case.
Yes, I'm familiar with Cabranes, and he's been cited throughout since her nomination. And I think it's very interesting to have him and others cited because it in a way undercuts the suggested argument that anyone who is Latina and comes from rather humble beginnings will have a certain point of view and a certain sort of sense of advocacy for the minority position in a given case. And we only have to think of Clarence Thomas to understand that that's a fallacy. Judges, even on the U.S. Supreme Court, understand better than anyone that these cases really are about the rule of law, as Justice, soon to be, I should say, Justice Sotomayor said yesterday in her opening statement, that they understand, even when they disagree vehemently about the outcome in these cases, that they have a great affection for the U.S. Constitution and for the rule of law. And those of us who are members of the public and have, I think, of course, great respect for our Constitution and really want the best outcome as well, but we have a different kind of sort of advocacy approach to cases and conversations about the great debates of the day. Judges don't approach the cases in the same way. So, Cabranes may criticize, may disagree, but if you were to sit down and have a conversation with him, he, I am sure, would not approve of the kind of criticism that she has received since her nomination. The personal attacks and I would say name-calling and ad hominem critique of the judge. Certainly, you can criticize her as a matter of law if you want to, as the U.S. Supreme Court did in Ricci, talk about the mistake she may have made in a particular case as a matter of legal error. That's one thing. But to deliberately misunderstand her positions from a political point of view, that's not how judges think. And so I think to cite Cabranes and some of the other judges, I don't think it's appropriate
we'll continue.
In this this setting.
We'll continue our coverage in just a minute. Jamie Floyd, host of Best Defense on the In Session TV network. Erica Gonzalez, opinion page editor at El Diario La Prensa. Thank you both very much. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with our coverage of the Sonia Sotomayor confirmation hearings today. We will pick it up again live with the next senator to question her, Senator Russell Feingold, Democrat from Wisconsin. Then we'll hear the questioning by Senator Orrin Hatch. Currently, if you want to listen to Senator Herb Kohl's questioning of Sotomayor, you can do so at WNYC.org, where we have a live stream going. But by way of background for just a few minutes, the seat that Sotomayor is up for was held by the legendary liberal Justice William Brennan before he retired and David Souter replaced him. And so we've invited Bert Newborn, legal director of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU, to talk about the legacy of the justice who so famously held that seat for many years. Professor Newborn, welcome back to WNYC.
Good to be here.
And just so our listeners who don't know can know, Brennan is considered historically a very liberal justice and is remembered for expanding civil liberties, freedom of the press, some other things. What decisions is he most known for?
Well, he was appointed by Eisenhower back in 1956. Eisenhower appointed some remarkable judges, one of whom and served until 1990. So he served a very, very long time on the court. He wrote 1,360 opinions, truly a kind of remarkable achievement. And he was among those opinions were Baker versus Carr, the reapportionment case, Texas versus Johnson, the flag burning case that protected it as free speech, Times v. Sullivan, the famous libel case that set up the First Amendment, Goldberg v. Kelly, the case that set up due process protection, Sherbert versus Berner, the case that set up religious protection. I mean, in many ways, over his remarkable tenure, he wrote the modern Constitution, and that's the seat that Sonia Sotomayor will be sitting in. And, of course, David Souter sat in it for 19 years and was I think, faithful to the Brennan legacy. He didn't expand it, but he never tried to cut it back.
President Eisenhower, who appointed Brennan, was a Republican. Did he know what he was getting in Justice William Brennan?
Well, it's interesting. He made three quick appointments. He appointed Earl Warren, Warren was a Republican governor of California. Then he appointed John Harlan, who was a really Mandarin judge on the Second Circuit here in New York. And then he felt, both of them were Republicans, he felt he needed a Democrat. And he wanted a Catholic because it would help him in the upcoming presidential elections. And so he chose Brennan. Brennan gave no indication before he was appointed that he was going to be the kind of justice that he was. He was a labor lawyer in New Jersey, but a management side labor lawyer, not a union labor lawyer. He represented management. There was no hint that he was going to explode onto the judicial world as the reformer that he turned out to be.
He also had a big personality and was seen as a consensus builder, a playmaker who somehow managed to get five votes for very liberal opinions.
Well, he was a remarkably kind man. I mean, there wasn't a person in the Supreme Court who didn't love him, from the gardeners to the elevator operators to the people who worked in the restaurant. I mean, he genuinely cared about them. He knew about their kids. He knew about their families. He would always, put his arm around you and talk to you. And it wasn't affectation. This was a guy who loved people, and it made him a tremendously, tremendously effective political force. There's a story that goes around that says that when Brennan's law clerks would meet for the first time, he had a new set of law clerks each year, and when his law clerks would meet for the first time, he would give them a quiz, and the quiz was, what's the most important legal rule in American law? And by the third or fourth year, everybody knew the answer, but they played along, and they would say, the First Amendment, the rule against perpetuities, they would come out with all these technical rules, and Brennan would smile, and he would hold up his hand, and he would say, no, it's the rule of five. You gotta get five votes. And he was superb at it, just superb. Interestingly, when Scalia was appointed, there was a sense, because he is a remarkably pleasant and affable man. I mean, you'd never know it from the acerbic nature of his opinions, but in person, he's really quite a lovely man. And there was a fear that in the left that Scalia was going to do for conservatives what Brennan had done for liberals all those years. And interestingly enough, Scalia became so caught up in his opposition to abortion and to his deep belief that what was going on was fundamentally immoral, that it drove him into a series of very angry attacks on those of his middle-of-the-road colleagues, mostly Justice O'Connor, who wouldn't go along with him. And before you knew it, he'd lost the chance to become a consensus
that leader. Well, interesting. Now, we just have about 45 seconds left, but give me a quick reaction to something the free speech lawyer Martin Garbus said on the show yesterday. He said, "I think someone like Thurgood Marshall was a highly political person, as was Justice Brennan or some of the other great liberal judges who had really worked the court. They were concerned about taking the court, which is a political institution, and playing it and getting to certain reconciled decisions. That's not Judge Sotomayor."
Well, I think that's correct. I mean, Sotomayor is not going to be Brennan, or at least she's not going to be Brennan yet. I thought that Sessions said something very interesting toward the end. He said, "Well, listen, I know what you've been for 17 years. For 17 years, you've been a tightly buttoned up, constrained judge who followed precedent. I'm a little nervous about what you're going to be like when we let you loose on the Supreme Court." So there's no telling what will happen
right.
once.
But her history is that she would not be Brennan.
Her history is that she ain't Bill Brennan. She's a much narrower, much, much more cautious judge.
Bert Newborn, legal director for the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU. Thank you so much. Really interesting.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.